Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. Today on the show, we follow along as a Shoshone elder teaches a younger tribal member the Shoshone language.
So I learned English with them so I could speak both, so I didn't get whipped in school.
White supremacist trolls have been interrupting the Laramie City Council with hateful anti-Semitic comments.
It's disruptive to this meeting, besides being odious.
The University of Wyoming Symphony Orchestra traveled to Europe for the first time in 17 years. We get to go along too.
It was gorgeous in there, and like even from the outside, it just didn't seem real to actually be there.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Grab your coffee and watch a live discussion of Cheyenne Roundup with Wyoming Public Media and Wyofile State Government reporters for an overview of the 2024 budget session. Special guest and longtime state government journalist and former Wyoming Public Media news director Bob Beck will moderate the conversation. Join us Monday, March 25th at 9 a.m. Register at wyomingpublicmedia.org on our events page.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does, on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. We're going to go back to about 2 weeks ago to get a firsthand look at how lawmakers decided what to do with more than $50 million in remaining American Rescue Plan Act funds, or ARPA for short. Wyoming received $1.1 billion in ARPA funding in 2021. The Biden administration asked that states use the funds for health and human services, infrastructure, water, and sewer projects, among others. To set the scene, it's the second to last day of the Wyoming legislature's budget session. Lawmakers have worked for the past 4 weeks to pass a budget, but that $50 million from ARPA is still up in the air. The clock is ticking. One project quickly turned contentious. Wyoming Public Radio's David Dudley has this story.
There's a 1-million-gallon water tank in Wheatland, an hour's drive north of Cheyenne. It's been leaking for years, and it's getting worse. Town officials have raised $6.6 million for repairs through various channels, but they're still short by $2 million. Wheatland Representative Jeremy Haroldson steps up to the microphone to ask the House for funds in the Omnibus Water Bill to fix the failing tank. In this case, Omnibus is an umbrella term that covers water projects across the state. The water tank in question provides drinking water for the Black Mountain community in Wheatland. If it isn't fixed soon, the water that sustains life could turn deadly for roughly 1,000 residents.
We are at a point where we've had an engineer tell us that we are one bad storm away or one instance away from 700,000 gallons going through our community. I want you guys to let that sink in for a second.
Lawmakers mull Haroldson's request. But some, like Democratic Laramie Representative Trey Sherwood, are unmoved.
I would say let's not drain this leaking water tank any further by draining our account any further. So vote your conscience.
Some argue that Haroldson isn't using the right avenues to secure funding. Haroldson is perplexed. He says that they've done everything possible to raise the funds.
We've passed a six-penny tax in our community to raise money out of our own community. We increased our water cost per customer.
Despite the urgency of his plea to the House of Representatives, Haroldson's cause was stripped from the omnibus water bill. Wheatland, population 3,600, is still facing an emergency. But what does that emergency look like on the ground? Volunteer firefighter Alan Snook and his family live two blocks from the tank. Snook says he's watched it closely since they moved there in 2018, and it's only gotten worse.
The rust on the outside, water coming out of the tank. You know, when it got super cold here recently, you could actually see the ice build up on the outside, and it actually broke some of the ladder off that goes up the side of the tank.
As a first responder, Snook worries about his neighbors. Many are elderly. There are two schools nearby, a nursing home. He would have to spring into action if 700,000 gallons of water were to flood the community. Plus, he worries about potentially worse problems.
The rumors there have been birds that get in there, and of course the town has to adjust all the chemicals in there accordingly to combat all of that stuff. So you wonder what all that excess stuff is doing to the water system and us that drink it.
Back at the House of Representatives, Haroldson paces the floor. The discussion turns to ARPA funds that are yet to be spent. Maintaining vital public services, like water, amid declines in revenue is just one of many ways to use the funds. Suddenly, Haroldson's ask is alive again. Some representatives are still pushing against the request, but Lander Representative Lloyd Larson says they do have a heart, and Wheatland's situation is dire.
They realize that this is a community that probably has used all the resources they have available, and based on their ability to generate sales tax and other fees, are kind of wit's end.
Eventually, members of the House add an amendment to Senate File 132 that would give $2 million in ARPA funds to the town of Wheatland. It went to vote.
The question is, shall the bill pass? Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Brown.
Aye.
The result? 60 ayes to 2 noes. After the vote, Haroldson says he's relieved. The first thing he did?
I got to contact my community and said, hey, we got the money. This is really exciting, and it's something that's available immediately, which is really good as well.
With the remainder of his funds in hand, Haroldson says they will drain the water tank as soon as possible. Then they'll begin building a new one. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm David Dudley.
Staying in the budget session, people living in and around the Tetons have said in recent years that they don't feel like their voices are being heard in Wyoming's capital. As the northwestern region becomes increasingly unaffordable for many, it's grappling with issues unique to it and far from where statewide decisions that affect local residents are being made. So Jackson and Teton County officials have made it a priority to play a larger role in building relationships in the eastern part of the state and bring attention to the priorities of locals. As Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Fipula-Ankeny reports, at least for one town official, that's meant calling Cheyenne home during budget talks this year.
Driving away from the capital, Arne Jorgensen checks the road conditions as he heads west, across a snow-swept landscape, back towards the rugged Tetons.
These high grasslands in Wyoming are amazing. I never get tired of the view. I know a lot of people get dismissive of it, but I just find it's Wyoming, and it's something that I really appreciate.
The Jackson Council member and vice mayor spent over 2 weeks at the state capitol on the town's dime during the budget session, attending floor sessions, meetings, and conferences with state lawmakers. He is headed back to Jackson in a Subaru the town loaned him, and says he's hopeful recent efforts to advocate for the region's local concerns will pay off.
Our current council recognizes the importance of making and building relationships around the state.
In years past, state legislation has been introduced that could have impacted Jackson and even eroded local government control, like a recent bill that aimed to make the Teton County Fairgrounds a state historical site, which could have affected the town's efforts to build more places for people to live. And in the fall, some lawmakers considered restricting the county's ability to provide affordable housing in a region with some of the largest wealth disparity in the United States.
I would say starting 5-6 years ago, there was a really strong recognition that we needed to be more involved as we were seeing more bills show up that were clearly targeted at Teton County, the town of Jackson.
Jorgensen says lots of Jackson Hole officials have driven to the large halls of the state's capital in recent years to try and have a stronger influence on state legislation.
A big point of discussion is local control. Leave decisions up to the elected officials closest to the people.
One new move that Jackson and Teton County made was to hire a pair of lobbyists skilled in networking and talking to politicians. Bob McLaurin used to be Jackson's town manager.
This whole lobbying game is about relationships. And it's something you do year round. It's not something you do in the 20 days of a budget session.
He now works with the Wyoming Association of Municipalities, an advocacy group for cities and towns throughout the state. He says paying for lobbyists is unique to Wyoming towns and counties, but in Jackson, necessary.
In Jackson, I think it's a prudent a prudent thing to do.
McLaurin says one big issue for Teton County residents has been property tax relief, which was a large subject of discussion this budget year. Rates have been spiking along with property values, which has contributed to the region's affordability crisis.
Increasingly, Jackson is a very, very important economic driver to state revenues.
And some residents may see some property tax relief soon, following the most recent legislative session. Also possibly resolved concerns around the much-talked-about Kelly Parcel, a piece of public land near the Tetons that could have been sold to developers, and local schools should benefit from more education funding. But Jackson and Teton County may still face an uphill battle as a blue island in a red state.
Wyoming has, over the last three decades, become increasingly Republican.
Jim King has spent over 30 years as a political science professor at the University of Wyoming. The majority of the state's lawmakers are Republican, and he says the party is fracturing.
You know, what you're seeing in this situation is a Republican, if you will, kind of the old guard versus the new guard. Wyoming legislature has, Republicans in the legislature have a Freedom Caucus that seems very similar to the Freedom Caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives.
This recently bubbled to the surface on the first day of this session when the Freedom Caucus shot down 13 bills on introductory votes. Further divisions between lawmakers led to the state house walking out of negotiations with the Senate over a $1 billion difference in initial budget proposals. They came to an agreement on the budget in the end, but tensions may continue to mount later this year as election season ramps up, both here and across the country.
I mean, that's one of those things. I mean, this is not unique to Wyoming. There has been generally an increase in the nationalization of elections. You see candidates running for governor, candidates running for other state offices, running against the national party.
Jackson Town Council member and Vice Mayor Arne Jorgensen says it's something he's seen firsthand.
The discussions have become less, and I want to be really careful here, less civil. There are more people are staking out their positions in ways that don't necessarily leave room for a compromise or middle ground. It's clearly different.
Wyoming is now less than a year away from the next legislative session that will kick off in January, and Jackson, Teton County, and the state may have new players at the table when it comes to future conversations about affordability, governance, and quality of life in 2025. Primary elections are coming up this summer, and the presidential election is this fall. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Dante Fopola-Inkney in Jackson.
Up next, the Laramie City Council has been dealing with interruptions in their meetings from nationwide actors. This is Open Spaces.
Did you know that all six episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
It is a joy to have Wyoming news, to enjoy Wyoming kind of music directed to a Wyoming type of culture, familiar voices.
I think Wyoming is lucky to have this. I think Wyoming appreciates it, and I think it's been supported in ways that testify to that.
Those were two brothers, Al and Pete. They made testimonials in appreciation of Wyoming Public Radio. You can join Al and Pete Simpson with a testimonial of your own. It's easy, and you can get the hang of it by going to our website and finding out more about our I Love Wyoming Public Radio campaign. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and join the folks who are letting their voices be heard.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. White supremacist trolls have been targeting the Laramie City Council for nearly half a year. What seemed at first like isolated hateful comments quickly revealed itself as a concerted attack on the council's ability to host public comments. Observers view attacks like these as assaults on the very ability of communities to be self-governing. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Fichter reports.
On a Tuesday night last October, a night just like any other, the Laramie City Council gaveled in for its regular meeting.
Good evening, everyone. It's October 17th, 2023, and I'm going to call this...
It was more or less a normal meeting for the council. That was until Mayor Brian Harrington cut to Zoom for public input. It was at that point the council was flooded with hateful comments. One of these Zoom commenters gave a false name and a false address before launching into a rant about atheists, Jews, and how America is allegedly getting away from its Christian roots. Harrington cut him off.
Mr. Hess, for one, 1488 Park Boulevard does not exist in the city of Laramie. And also the anti-Semitism will not be welcomed in this council.
But those comments were simply a taste of things to come. At the next meeting, it happened again. More anti-Semitic comments from random individuals identifying themselves with Nazi code names. After shutting down the third in a row that night, Mayor Harrington turned to legal counsel.
City Attorney, if this continues to be a pattern, I'm not sure that I am interested in us providing a platform for folks to insert their hateful comments into our meeting.
City Attorney Bob Southard was just as disturbed as the counselors.
I mean, it's disruptive to this meeting, besides being odious, and this council and this meeting does not have to listen to these people spout this filth.
Southard told the council it cannot require people to sign up beforehand, but it can put some sidebars on what's allowed. It's been a struggle back and forth ever since. The council adds new requirements for Zoom participants, or it scales back opportunities for virtual comment. And the trolls push back, squeezing in hateful comments in the moments before they're kicked out of the meeting. Throughout all of this, Laramie's city councilors have been left wondering, who's doing this? Jeremy Shaver, the Mountain West's regional director for the Anti-Defamation League, had a surprisingly specific answer.
The vast majority are the responsibility of an extremist group that holds virulent anti-Semitic beliefs.
The most likely culprits are the white supremacists who call themselves the Goyim Defense League. They have disrupted meetings across the country with similar tactics. These disruptions are usually carried out on Zoom. They'll log into the meeting virtually, then jam up public comments with hateful rhetoric until the government body is forced to close the comment period altogether. It happened once in Jackson and in several Colorado communities as well. Across the country, the group has disrupted more than 140 local government meetings since last summer. The disruptions in Laramie have not let up, and they take a toll on both the Laramie City councilors and staff, who have to carry on with the normal business of the city. Outside of the meetings, Harrington says it's incredibly difficult to make that shift.
Almost every week, it is a bunch of hateful stuff, and my heart gets racing, and like my face turns red, and I'm frazzled. And then I have to read a proclamation about something really great happening in the community, recognize a group doing good work, you know, something of that sort. And it's really hard to transition your brain from one of those things to the other.
Shaver says this attack on a local government's ability to even function is part of the point.
These extremists are hijacking these public comment periods, these opportunities for residents of local communities to participate in their local government.
The Laramie City Council has limited its open-ended public comment period to in-person comments only. For now, Zoom attendees can still comment throughout the meeting on specific agenda items. But the fascist disruptions are creeping into those parts of the meeting as well. At the most recent meeting, 5 full months since the first attack, Harrington preemptively warned the room before going to Zoom for public comment.
I'm just going to note for the folks in the room who have kids, these have gone off the rails a little bit in a way that you don't want your children to hear, probably.
The commenter tried to start, and Harrington told him to turn on his camera. The commenter did as he was asked, but appeared to have blocked the lens. The mayor, audibly weary in the face of another attempted disruption, told the city clerk to throw out their virtual guests.
Okay, we can remove this person. City clerk, I have a feeling I know where that's headed. If you do have a comment, please feel free to email the council. What a dumb thing we have to do.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jeff Victor.
Now we turn to ESG. It stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance. And it's basically a strategy where one considers those three things when deciding to invest, like investing in a company because of its stance on climate change or LGBTQ issues, and not necessarily solely because of the financial returns. ESG has created somewhat of a culture war between conservatives and liberals, where Republican states like Wyoming see it as a part of woke culture and even a threat to the fossil fuel industry. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan speaks with University of Colorado's assistant professor Matt Burgess, who researches the political polarization of environmental issues. Burgess starts off discussing the state of politics around ESG.
I think what's happening is, up until recently, you know, there are these very large investors that are throwing their weight behind ESG, and there are some governments that are throwing their weight behind ESG. And I think that at its core, the proponents want to do that for a combination of, we want the market to better internalize these market failures and to have more, you know, socially responsible capitalism. And because of these market failures, it's appropriate to use government power, even if it goes slightly against the short-term interest in the market. And then the opponents of ESG kind of have the opposite view, that sort of that they're saying, well, you know, you're basically pushing investors to invest for reasons other than their bottom line, and you're using government power in ways that are not always transparent in their objectives, right? The, you know, often and corporate power. There's, you know, when you're talking about, say, you know, big four investment firms getting behind something like ESG, I think you can, and as far as I understand it, some opponents have made the case that that could be an antitrust issue, right? That whether or not you agree with the benefits of what they're doing for society, the idea of large institutional investors that are private, that are, you know, not accountable to voters in the way that governments are, getting together and saying, we're going to consciously push the market in this direction, that is an antitrust competition issue. And then I think if you combine that with the fact that the conservatives in the United States have recently felt, I think that their opinions are represented less in major corporate power, in sense-making institutions like the media and academia, than they are held by the public. One of the questions that I often hear in the context of ESG is, you know, why are conservatives who historically have been at least somewhat libertarian, right, the whole Reagan doctrine about keep the government out of markets, why are they willing now seemingly to use government power against things like ESG? My sense is that the answer to that is that they think that there isn't another option, given how much power there is in, you know, in elite hands going against them, you know, more so than public opinion maybe goes against them.
In Wyoming this last summer, there were some rules passed where any companies doing business with the state have to disclose any ESG principles. But then Wyoming wanted to take it a step further and into the private investment world to have brokers and security agents have to disclose any ESG principles to their clients as well. And then the clients had to provide written consent. And that ultimately didn't pass. Our governor decided it was a little bit too much of government overreach, even though he said he doesn't support ESG.
It certainly is, you know, the government getting involved, the government saying that companies have to do something that they weren't always doing otherwise. But ultimately, all they're really asking for is disclosure and transparency. They're not saying that you can't have ESG principles, right? And that stands in contrast to, you know, I believe Texas and Florida were disinvesting some of their government funds from banks that were signing on to ESG pledges. So that's higher up the scale on you know, coercive government power. In economics, right, the stylized free market that does, you know, one of the most famous theorems in economics is basically called the first fundamental welfare theorem. And basically what it's about is kind of under what conditions does the free market efficiently allocate resources, right? And, you know, no transaction costs, perfect information, you know, are two of those conditions. So I think that there's a read on that Wyoming bill that says, well, this is the government trying to be coercive to stop or hinder ESG. I think there's also a read on that government bill that's saying this is the government asking for transparency in a way that's going to help the market work more efficiently, right? It's going to help people understand to what extent are companies investing based on specific values that they may or may not share, or are they investing, you know, based on profit. Now, the other question on the other side would be, to what extent is the government with that bill being selective in applying that principle, right? Right. If you're saying, you know, you have to disclose ESG and you have to do so in an onerous way and you don't have to disclose about anything else, then you could argue that you're in effect applying a restriction on ESG that you're not applying on other things. And so maybe the government in that case is putting its thumb on the scale.
Where do you see the ESG going, anti-ESG? I mean, how do you see this kind of unfolding in the states? It feels like there just is a lot of building tension.
My best guess in terms of the national picture is that, you know, there's a combination of, again, I believe that it is the case that, you know, overall unconstrained investment is going to do better, at least in the short term on average, than constrained investment. So I think that there may be a long-term market force against ESG. But on the other hand, one of the reasons businesses have been so engaged in ESG is that their research and polls suggest that young people are more conscious consumers than previous generations. And that's going to be a push in favor of ESG, right? That affects businesses' bottom line and that they're going to pursue irrespective of what the government says. And then also, you know, there's a lot of the culture wars are about messaging and branding, right? So, you know, everybody, like, inclusion is really popular. Equal opportunity is really popular. Racial essentialism and discrimination is unpopular. And so how does ESG, you know, get painted as one or the other of those, right? And do we change the name? And maybe also some bifurcation among states. I think it probably is the case that very blue states are going to keep going in one direction. Very red states might keep pushing in the other direction. It'll be interesting to see what the variation is within that, how companies that are broad across several states handle that, right? One of the things that we've seen in our research with utilities is that utilities that span multiple states that have different renewable electricity requirements often have ambitious targets in states that don't have any requirement to have a target because they also operate in other states that do, and they operate nationally in a national context where there are targets. There's also global markets, right? There are large pushes in the global marketplace towards aspects of ESG, towards aspects of climate, you know, risk disclosure that are not going away anytime soon. And then the short-term versus long-term, right? To the extent that companies not accounting for things like climate change, for things like climate risk, you know, the bigger the company, the more they might be influenced by long-term versus short-term considerations, and the more they may have a durable incentive to get out ahead of these issues, regardless of what the government is telling them in the short term, to the extent that they're allowed to.
And if you're just an everyday person, just walking around, maybe have a couple, you know, dabble a little bit with investing, is this something that one should be paying attention to, or does it not necessarily affect the average person?
I would, you know, in terms of just my general instincts for politics and the market, I would say that in the short term, these things can vary a lot, right? So if the year-to-year investment prospects of more ESG funds versus less ESG funds, some are going to be better in some years, others are going to be better in other years. Certainly in the long term, you know, companies that are managing themselves in a responsible way, that are limiting their long-term risk, that are, you know, building a healthy corporate culture, you know, I would expect naively them to be more successful in the long term. And so, if, you know, that's something to think about in terms of long-term investments. And then, you know, the last thing I'll say, which is less about investors and more kind of a maybe advice for activists, is never extrapolate too far or assume too much about how willing companies are to go against their financial interests, right? So companies went all in on those things, you know, 3-4 years ago, because that's where the winds were blowing in the market, right? And now they're pulling back from some of these things because that's the way the winds are blowing in the market. And so I think that the, you know, hard but necessary work is to, through innovation, you know, through advocacy to the extent that it's effective and reaches a big tent, to create market conditions where that's going to be the incentive, because the hoping that companies are going to go en masse against their economic incentives is, I think history shows, it isn't a winning battle.
Matt, is there anything else you want to add?
I guess just at a high level, I think the market and the private sector are really important aspects of our society and how we got to be as prosperous as we are. They're probably going to need to be really important and recently have been really important aspects in solving big problems like climate change and other environmental issues. But also, market failures are a thing. You know, the free market can't solve every problem on its own. And so we need, you know, good governance to hold the market accountable where it needs to be held accountable. And we need citizens to be engaged in, you know, all of that, both in entrepreneurship and in political participation and other things that help that system function better. And I think polarization is corrosive to all of these things. And so the more that we can talk to each other, the more that we'll understand each other, the more I think we'll understand that often there's good arguments on both sides that maybe even aren't always mutually exclusive in terms of what they imply we should do. So I hope to see more thoughtful conversations among people with diverse opinions about issues like climate change and ESG and these other issues that seem very hot right now. But ultimately, I think most people on both sides are trying to advance what they think is in the best interest of our country.
That was University of Colorado's assistant professor Matt Burgess speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan. We should note, Burgess will be starting as an assistant professor of economics at the University of Wyoming this fall. Soon, we tag along on an elk hunt where a Shoshone elder teaches a younger tribal member the cultural significance of the animal while learning the Shoshone language. That's up next on Open Spaces.
If you're searching for a break from the news, look no further than Wyoming Public Media. We provide 3 music channels for whatever may be your taste or mood: Classical Wyoming, Jazz Wyoming, and Wyoming Sounds. You can find them all on a variety of platforms for listening, including streaming, Wyoming Public Radio app, smart speakers, and FM radio. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and listen.
Join us for the newsroom from the BBC, and we'll bring you a fresh and lively look at what's happening in the world. Using our extensive network of correspondents, we take you to the story as it breaks. Get the facts and hear the experts on the newsroom from the BBC.
Weeknights at 7 on Wyoming Public Radio, followed by Classical Wyoming from 8 to 11.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kudelska. Earlier this winter, Shoshone elders and younger tribal members gathered at a remote ranch in the Grovant Mountains of western Wyoming. They were there to hunt for elk and learn about the cultural significance of the animal. And much of those teachings were delivered in the Shoshone language. Wyoming Public Radio's Courtney Blackmer reports.
What's that?
Oh. There's a bull just working this in front of us. But there's another one that might be closer. Kind of around this
this corner. We're going to work to this edge right here. Okay. That's where it opens up and you can see that whole meadow.
Yeah.
George Hardin, a Shoshone elder, and Justin Washington, a Shoshone tribal member, are crouched behind a stand of trees with the hunting guide from a nearby ranch. In front of them is a small herd of elk.
I smelled them earlier. Can you smell them? There he is.
A bull elk steps out into Hardin's sights and he shoots. The bull falls and the group approaches it. Hardin says a prayer over the elk. Hardin is one of the few remaining fluent speakers of the Shoshone language. He has come to this event, put on by the Shoshone Cultural Center, to help educate Shoshone people about the tribe's language and traditions. Hardin grew up in a Shoshone-speaking household, but this is increasingly uncommon. He says that many Shoshone parents he grew up around didn't want their kids to learn the language for fear that they would be punished for speaking it.
When I went to first grade in Ruby Valley, our neighbors, they talked Shoshone, and I used to see them get whipped when they'd talk Shoshone in the classroom. But I was lucky. Like I said, my aunt and uncle were raising their kids to learn English, so I learned English with them so I could speak both, so I didn't get whipped in school.
The forced and often violent assimilation of Native children in American schools resulted in widespread loss of Indigenous culture and language. This has a lasting effect today. Unlike Hardin, Washington didn't have the opportunity to learn the Shoshone language or culture as a child. He was adopted at a young age, so he didn't grow up around his culture. But as he's grown older, he's made an effort to reconnect to his tribe.
The reason why I would like to learn and continue learning is it's a source of identity, something that you can attach yourself to.
And now he wants to pass on what he knows to his two young daughters.
So having George here show me and teaching me and guiding and helping me with the songs and prayers and also how to hunt and process the kill and say prayers over it. It's deeply rooted in our traditions and in our heritage. So to continue it's an honor and a blessing.
The day after the hunt, Hardin shows Washington how to make a war shield using willows and elk hide.
We're going to bend it like that to make a circle, don't worry.
Mm-hmm.
Or that'd be the top. And then maybe we'll get another one, then we make a circle out of it. We tie them together with body adamo, with elk tendon, or then you make that circle I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put them across like this.
Over the course of the gathering, Hardin shared a wide range of cultural knowledge, including how to make instruments out of elderberry, how to write songs for different occasions, and how to prepare elk meat in the traditional way. For Washington, the experience inspired him to continue learning about and teaching his culture.
Well, sure enjoyed hunting with you.
Yeah, likewise, man.
We got to keep it going.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Because after I'm too old to come hunting, then you could be the one doing their singing and
making shields and showing the young bucks how to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's what we're here for, to pass it on.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, I'm at that stage now where I want to pass everything I learned on. And I'm so glad Justin's willing to carry it on. That's what we need, younger generations and even the younger ones. We need that to keep our culture going.
And that's exactly what the organizers of this event set out to do, preserve the Shoshone language and culture for future generations. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Courtney Blackmer. Thank you.
Over the past year, media organization GRIST located and mapped more than 8 million acres of land taken from more than 120 indigenous nations. They showed how these lands have produced billions of dollars for 14 land-grant universities, one of which is the University of Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman spoke with Tristan Atone, GRIST editor-at-large, and Maria Perazzo-Rose, a spatial data analyst at GRIST, about the project.
Land-grant universities are a set of institutions that sort of owe their beginnings to something called the Morrill Act, which was signed into existence by Abraham Lincoln in 1862. And what that law did was more or less take newly acquired land, land that had been taken from tribes. The law then cut that land up and distributed it to those institutions in order to sell or make money off of that land in order to get off the ground.
What is the relationship between these universities and state trust lands?
These institutions were first given land to get off the ground, but state trust lands were also provided to these institutions to continue to produce revenue for them. So it's not just a one-time gift through the Morrill Act, it's a new piece of legislation that's establishing these state trust lands that provide a new source of revenue. So state trust lands are basically established when states become states as part of their graduation and their sort of like dowry for joining the union. You know, they pass enabling acts, and usually in these enabling acts, land is granted to institutions like universities, but also to other sort of infrastructure in the state. In Wyoming, I believe a miners' hospital, penitentiary, K through 12 schools, a lot of different sort of like state institutions benefit from these trust lands.
What were some of the top findings or things that really stood out to you all as you started looking at this data?
The big thing was sort of like the sheer amount of acreage. Our findings put it at about 8.3 million surface and subsurface acres of land. But I think one of the biggest ones was the amount of money that institutions are making off of these lands. So between 2018 and 2022, we were able to track about $6.6 billion in revenue that were coming off of these lands. And, you know, looking at how much was actually like paid for those lands, if anything was paid at all to indigenous nations, our calculations put it at maybe the U.S. paid about $4.3 million in title for these lands, which is just a tiny, tiny amount compared to that $6.6 billion. When the U.S. actually paid anything, for instance, Arizona, those lands were taken through combat and conflict. So in almost the entire state of Arizona, nothing was ever paid to any of the tribes for that land.
One thing to add to that, too, is when we talk about how these trust lands have generated revenue for universities, for all these different beneficiaries, the way that that's happening is through all different kinds of land use activity, predominantly through different kinds of leasing. And in our investigation, we found a lot of different kinds of extractive activity as well. And so ultimately, we found roughly a quarter of all of the lands were designated for some kind of extractive activity. And it's interesting to see that in relation to other kinds of activity, for example, renewables constituted, I think, 0.25% of all the land, so fractions in comparison.
One of the universities included in your investigation is the University of Wyoming. What did your reporting find specifically about how the University of Wyoming is benefiting from indigenous land and how that revenue is being created?
Well, our data shows that University of Wyoming benefits from a combined about 223,000 acres. We have established that that land was taken from about 22 different indigenous nations, and that between fiscal year 2018 and 2022, Wyoming made about $5.4 million off of those lands. About $95,000 was paid by the United States for title to those lands. So we're able to sort of see like the large land footprint that's going on there in Wyoming alone.
For activities, as of November 2023, which is when our data set is dated to, there's the majority of the leases that we see are grazing leases, but there's also a good amount of oil and gas leasing and metallic and non-metallic mineral leasing. There is extractive activity going on there as well.
To summarize, state trust lands continue to transfer wealth that benefits land-grant universities. Have any of these universities acknowledged this? Are they giving back to Indigenous nations or supporting Native students in any way?
Short answer is no. In our reporting, there is only really one university that we're aware of that is, well, maybe two, that are aware of their state trust lands and sort of this history with them. So South Dakota State University has been covered quite a lot for their acknowledgement of Morrill Act lands and state trust lands, et cetera, and send revenue from those lands to support Native students. We're aware that some of the schools that we talk to, like Washington State University, know about this stuff, but have not necessarily made any sort of strides toward putting those resources into Native students or anything.
Personally, one thing that I've just been thinking about a lot is, you know, these land-grant universities built up their institutions off of these lands, which at one point were their primary source of income, but that's no longer the case. And so I think it opens up this avenue for questioning, you know, around how universities at this point in time are truly benefiting from these lands. To what extent is that a part of their overall portfolio? And it's just a good place to ask questions, I think.
That was Grist Editor-at-Large Tristan Ottone and Grist Spatial Data Analyst Maria Perazzo-Rose talking with Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman about their investigation into land-grant universities, state trust lands, and Indigenous land. Up next, we go to Europe with the University of Wyoming Symphony Orchestra. This is Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Radio takes you around Wyoming. Listen for interesting stories from down the long streets and around the state. Around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:30 and 4:48. If you have a Wyoming story of interest, you can send it to me at ingel@uwyo.edu. Thanks.
A new season of the Modern West is coming your way. This time, Wyoming Public Radio reporters dig into stories from across the West.
We are traveling since Patagonia in Chile, and we're going to Alaska.
It's like two worlds that don't understand each other.
I really do believe courage is like a muscle.
High Altitude Tales, it's season 8 of the Modern West. Catch the trailer now under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The University of Wyoming Symphony Orchestra traveled internationally for the first time in 17 years over their spring break. The group toured through southern France and Spain. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Saunders, who's also a member of the orchestra, took us with them on the trip.
The orchestra settles into our chairs as we begin to tune for our last performance in Europe. Our tour abroad would soon be coming to a close, but how do we get here? With a mix of nerves and excitement, 60 of us settled down for a long 10-hour flight to Germany and an extra connecting flight to France. The trip was delayed by about a day, throwing carefully made plans out the window and canceling our first performance. Our first full day there, we got to explore. Some of us spent our morning walking along the Promenade des Anglais, basically a boardwalk by the ocean that had a small open-air market stocked with fresh produce, pottery, and soaps. Tori Martinez, a freshman violinist, had never been to Europe before. She spent her time getting a feel for the local atmosphere.
We kind of walked around. We got to see the ocean. We got to tour around. I got some macarons. And so we've just kind of been touring around downtown, and it's been gorgeous.
It was a learning experience for everyone, including trying authentic French cuisine.
I tried carbonara for the first time. I think all of the food here is just so good. But yeah, the carbonara was really good. I didn't really know what it was, but I wanted to like try new things.
A big part of this trip was visiting historic places like Avignon, which is known for housing the 195th Pope Clement V after Rome was declared too dangerous. Our first performance was in a nearby small village named L'Île-sur-la-Sorgue. Director Dr. Michael Griffith chose a piece for us to play and made its world premiere in Europe. 7 o'clock Shout was composed by Valerie Coleman during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic.
If people live near where hospital workers were
all coming out of the hospital after work shift. Sometimes they would go out in the front of their houses and sort of applaud or cheer. And in Philadelphia, this one neighborhood around a hospital, this was a daily tradition that at 7 o'clock the people would come out and give a shout out to all these hospital workers who would risk their lives to protect us all.
That's the song you're hearing now. The piece starts off with a trumpet duet playing on either side of the stage, followed by a soft roll from the timpani. The rest of the group joins in with a piccolo solo. It later features a repeated section with shouting and stomping from the orchestra.
It's very beautiful. At the beginning, it's sort of bright and slow and perhaps a little bit nostalgic.
7 o'clock Shout got its second performance in Barcelona. In both concerts, we also played other compositions, including Wagner's Meistersingers. Excerpts from the opera Carmen that also featured a vocalist. And La Forza de Destino by Giuseppe Verdi. Our last day in Europe was bittersweet. We spent it in the city center of Barcelona, shopping along the bustling market of Las Ramblas. Lunch was a unique experience because we got to make it ourselves in a cooking class. We made gazpacho in a traditional rice dish with squid ink called paella. Our last stop of the trip was the church La Sagrada Familia, where musicians played in the courtyard. The church has been in construction for 142 years, aimed to be finished in 2026. The building displays impressive architecture and stained glass windows telling the story of Christmas and the birth of Christ. Martinez says the tour we took meant the experience was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
It was gorgeous in there, and like even from the outside, it just didn't seem real to actually be there. And then you go inside and you get to see the stained glass and the statues and all the details within the church. And having the tour guide there like really was able to enhance the experience for me, and just being in there was completely unreal.
She says this trip was a life-changing experience for her, and that sentiment is shared with the orchestra as a whole, including myself. Our concert season doesn't end in Europe, but with a final performance on May 2nd at the Buchanan Center for the Performing Arts. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Saunders.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Engel, our audio and digital producer, and Eric Vigil, our social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.